review something, okay? In the Sinaitic law, which could be called the Sinaitic covenant, or it could be called the Levitical economy, or it could be called the Mosaic law, whatever, there's a sort of a sectional aspect to this. There's first of all the moral law, which are the Ten Commandments. Okay. And then there's a section that I call, I'm having trouble with this thing, the way this cord is run here. Maybe that'll take care of it. I call it the civil law, but it's not called that in the Old Testament. It's really called the Book of the Covenant. Will you look at chapter 24 of Exodus and verse 7? After the communication of chapters 21 and 22 and 23, Moses comes down off of the mount, and in the 7th verse of chapter 24, we're told, and he took the Book of the Covenant, and he read in the audience of the people, and they said, all that the Lord hath said will we do, and we'll be obedient. This civil law is often called the Book of the Covenant. Okay? And it's made up of civil laws that implement the Ten Commandments. And when we went through the Ten Commandments, I did a lot of reading in that Book of the Covenant to try to illustrate that this section is really an implementation. The third section, of course, is the ceremonial law. The ceremonial law, which is the religious law or the way of approach to God. And it will include all of the laws of the priesthood and offerings and sacrifices. And actually, that makes up a large part of the Sinaitic Covenant, Exodus 25 to about, you have to say to about 40, there's some interspersings in there, and then also the book of Leviticus. Okay? Now, tonight we begin the second part, the book of the covenant. Okay? So if you're taking notes, the book of the covenant actually technically extends from Exodus chapter 20 and verse 22. You don't see that in the King James. It's not reflected there. It really runs from Exodus 20, verse 22, through chapter 23. Okay? And tonight we're going to try to deal with Exodus chapter 21. Verse 1 of chapter 21 says, now these are the judgments. Now the word that's translated judgments is the Hebrew word mishpat, in the plural form with an article. These are, and then there's an article, the mishpatim, or the judgments, or the laws, or the ordinances, okay, which thou shalt set before them. If thou buy a Hebrew servant or a Hebrew slave, 6 years shall he serve, and so on, and so on. So what you have in verses 1 through 11, this is chapter 21, verses 1 through 11, are the rights of Hebrew slaves. Those rights are going to be delineated in those verses, 21 verses 1 through 11. Okay, mishpat, you know, is a judgment, an expression of something that's firm. So the King James translates it judgments. The New American Standard translates the word ordinances. It just means laws and so on. Now you never want to forget when you're reading this that this this is God. This is not some social organization or some law based on some social relativity. These are direct commands coming from God. It's kind of exciting. When the German higher critics were having their fun in the last century, from about 1850 to about 1890, they would take a section like this and they'd say, now see this. The Hebrew Torah ascribes this to Moses. And the expressions in these laws are so sophisticated that they couldn't have been written in the time of Moses. The social evolutionary process had not reached that far politically and socially to have such a delineation of law like you have in the Book of the Covenant. So really, these were not written in the time of Moses. They were written about 400 B.C. And then some scribe just got and put them into the Old Testament where they are, into the Book of Exodus. And God let them rant and rave like that for about 50 years. Then he let the archaeologists discover the stela of Hammurabi. You know, have you seen that black obelisk stela where the code of Hammurabi is on there? And they found it broken in three pieces. And they put it together, and here's the whole code of Hammurabi, which antedates this by 300 years at least. And you have a very similar system spelled out. You have a lot of differences, but you have a similar system of a law system totally spelled out in the Code of Hammurabi. It just shut their mouths, you know, just made fools out of them. Well, these are judgments and ordinances not of a social situation, but of God giving special judgments and how to function to the children of Israel. And as we said, they will implement the moral law. All right. Verse 1 is regulation number 1 relative to Hebrew servants. Okay, and it simply says that Hebrew servants or slaves is the idea, were to be set free. In the seventh year of their servitude. In the seventh year of their servitude. Okay? Okay. Without charge, that is. In other words, they didn't have to redeem themselves after 7 years or pay a price. They were to be set free. Verse 2. If you buy a Hebrew slave or Hebrew servant, 6 years shall he serve. And in the seventh, he shall go out free for nothing. And notice the King James expression. He shall go out free for nothing. Now, as soon as I read this, I was curious, of course, how one could become a Hebrew slave. And how did this happen? And so I did some investigating and came up with maybe 4 ways of becoming a Hebrew slave. 4 ways one became. Now, you'll notice it's a Hebrew slave. It's one of their own. It's not some foreigner that they made a slave, that they conquered in a war and he became a slave. It's a Hebrew, one of their own. Okay? Okay, first of all, in the ways of becoming a Hebrew slave, a courts could sell thieves as restitution. Courts could sell thieves as restitution. In other words, within the Levitical covenant itself, within the Mosaic economy, whenever somebody stole something, you always had to pay it back somehow. Sometimes you had to pay fourfold. Now, if you couldn't pay it back, then you could be sold as a slave to that person. You became his indentured servant. See? Look at chapter 22, verse 1 through 3. If a man steal an ox or a sheep and kill it or sell it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox, 4 sheep for a sheep. If a thief be found breaking up and be smitten that he die, there shall no blood be shed for him. If the sun be risen upon him, there shall be blood shed for him, for he should make full restitution. If he have nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. And the court and the judges would have to put some type of a servitude price upon what this man had done. So suppose he stole a, or suppose he killed an oxen that was they deemed was worth 100 denarius, or 100 shekels, and the average pay was 1 denarius a day or 1 shekel a day. Well, then the guy would be sold into slavery or servitude for 100 days to the person to whose ox he killed. Okay, so that's one way. Second way that one could become a slave. Hebrew children. were sometimes sold. We don't have many instances of this. Remember the widow that Elisha went to see, and her husband had died, and she had an indebtedness, and she couldn't pay it. And remember the oil in the barrels were running dry? I think I remember the story, right? And her problem was that her two sons had been sold to the creditor under this very system, because she couldn't pay her bills. And then Elisha performed a miracle with the oil and told her to sell it and redeem her sons and so on, if you remember that story. There aren't too many instances of this, and every place that you have it, it's very negative. In other words, the scriptures are speaking very harshly about the economic system and the harshness of it at the time. They're very negative about it. So if you want some passages, they would be Amos chapter 2 and verse 6, and chapter 8 and verse 6, two negative passages. Nehemiah 5:5 is a very clear passage, speaks very much to the point. And 2 Kings 4:1-7 is that story of Elisha. Hebrew children were sold due to severe economic distress. All those passages are very negative. Slavery was not a desirable social behavior in ancient Israel, but it did occur. And it occurred largely because of severe economic distress. Okay? There was another form of slavery. It was indentured servitude. Okay? In other words, suppose you had you incurred a debt, and a recession hit, and you couldn't pay the debt. Well, you could then volunteer your services to the person for a period of time. We had many voluntary indentured servants at the founding of the colonies in the United States. In fact, a large number of the people on the Mayflower, of the what do you do when you're boaters? Is that what you said? Not the Pilgrims. The Pilgrims were the ones. They had the money. They were the ones who had the indentured servants working for them. Pilgrims were very, very sharp economically, I'll guarantee you. When you ride on a boat, what do you call that? You're a passenger. Many of the passengers on the Mayflower were indentured servants. And one of the real reasons for the Mayflower Compact was that the Pilgrims were not going to let these indentured servants run that colony. And they made the Mayflower Compact, and they made it pretty clear in the Mayflower Compact who was going to be in control. Okay, so there was that also in Israel, to pay a debt. Okay? Okay. Now, the distinction in this kind of thing was that they had to be treated like a hired worker. Well, you look at Leviticus chapter 25, verse 35 and 39. Leviticus chapter 25. And verse 35. The passage actually runs through about verse 40, on beyond verse 40. Verse 35, if a brother be waxen poor and fallen in decay with you, then thou shalt relieve him, yea, though he be a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. Take thou no usury of him or increase, but fear thy God, that thy brother may live with you. Thou shalt not give him thy money upon usury, nor lend him thy victuals for increase. Okay, and then in verse 39 it says, if thy brother that dwelleth with you be waxen poor and be sold unto you, thou shalt not compel him to serve as a bondservant, but as a hired servant, as a sojourner. He shall be with you and shall serve you unto the year of Jubilee. Okay? Okay. The fourth way, a captive of war. Captives of war were considered property. The property of the person who spared them. Okay. Okay. Now the point of verse 1 was that regardless of how the servant became yours, after 6 years, he was to be set free, or if the year of Jubilee came before that, which was every 50th year, all slaves were set free. Okay? So there were two ways. Either he served at his term, or all slaves set free in the year of Jubilee. It didn't matter if he only had 2 years of service in and he was supposed to serve six. If the year of Jubilee came, which was every 50th year of the religious calendar, all indentured servants were to be set free. All land was to go supposed to go back to the original owners and so on. We never have recorded any instance where Israel observed the year of Jubilee in Scripture. Okay? Okay, point B, second regulation concerning, question. Well, it really doesn't apply much to a Hebrew. It's possible, though, that there could be some type of civil war, and it's possible that one could become a slave that way. And it isn't that God's condoning it. It's just that it could happen that way. Number 4 would apply, of course, mostly to foreigners. Okay. What we're saying, in effect, if you look up these passages and look up the passages on slavery in Israel, you'll find that it was very much discouraged as a social practice, but that it was very much different than, say, the Code of Hammurabi or any other national code that we have in ancient times relative to slaves. Their laws were much, much more strict, and you did not treat a slave as a human being under their law system. They were very, very exacting. But under this system, you're going to find a lot of protection for that indentured servant or that slave that you have. Okay. Point B is regulation number 2. Yeah. No. Well, when we come to it, I will. Not at this point. It was just the 50th year of the calendar. It was supposed to be like a sacred year or a sacred feast time, and we'll come to it in Leviticus 23. Just like, say, you had the Passover once a year. Well, the year of Jubilee only came once every 50 years. Okay, verse 3. Now, maybe he was married when he came in, or maybe he got married after he came to be a servant. So it says, if he came in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he were married, then his wife shall go out with him. So the marital status, this regulation states, was upon initiation. I'm sorry, I spelled that wrong. The marital status upon initiation determines the status upon termination. Okay, and this was a protection, you see, of the rights of that slave. Now, regulation number 4, point C, I'm sorry, regulation number 3, which is verse 4, states this: if his master has given him a wife, and she have borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's. And he shall go out by himself if he wants to go. He has the option, okay? So the third regulation is simply this. A wife and children received after becoming a slave remains the property of the master. If the slave once released, he can, okay? Okay, the next regulation is really an option, verse 5 and 6. This is an option. Okay, and the option states this: and if the servant shall plainly say, I love my master, I love my wife and my children, I choose not to go free, then his master shall bring him unto, the King James translates the word, the judges. I looked at the New American last week, and it translates it unto God. I think the best translation is like the King James has, the judges. He shall also bring him to the door, or to the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl, like an ice pick. He takes his ear and he puts it up against the lintel of the doorpost, and he takes an ice pick and he just runs it through that part of his ear, and he nails him to the wall, or to the lintel of the doorpost, which is a symbolic way of depicting the permanent fixation of that slave to that household forever. He becomes a slave forever. He does it by his option, by his choice. Okay? So the option here is voluntary, permanent servitude. Voluntary, permanent servitude. You know, I was thinking when I was working on this passage, how blessed we are economically in our country that this is so foreign to us. During the Depression, there were certain types of expression of voluntary servitude. Children would deliver groceries at a corner grocery store for maybe a nickel a delivery. Take your wagon down and you deliver the groceries. You know, they tell you who bought the groceries, and you pull a couple bags home in a wagon and you get a nickel for each delivery. Well, on Saturday, maybe you'd make 10 deliveries. It's 50 cents. Well, you didn't get the 50 cents. It came off your mother and dad's bill in the grocery store. There was a man named Harry Hoffman that in the neighborhood I lived in, he was a Jewish man. He had a little corner grocery store. He took the whole neighborhood through the Depression. And when we moved 10 blocks away from there, sometime about 1935, I remember by 1941, I was still, each week I'd be taking $5 down to Harry Hoffman to take off the bill. 6 years later. We've been so blessed economically that this kind of information seems so far removed from us, when really it hasn't been far removed from us. It hasn't been, you know, 100 years ago there were still people that were indentured servants in the United States. And we have, the economic prosperity of this country is absolutely incredible over the last 100 years. And so it seems maybe strange, but it really is still not strange in parts of our world in which we live in today. Well, this was an option for a man who identified very strongly with his master, and maybe he had a family that was part of his master's doing, and so he chose to stay there, and he became a permanent slave to that household. And the way that he symbolized it was by having his ear pierced. Okay? Okay. Now, you'll notice that it had to be done. There had to be a judgment rendered on it because it was a special case. There was no such thing as a permanent slave or permanent servant in the Israelitish economy except it be voluntary. So it had to be done before the judges. Okay, and the word simply is Ha Elohim. Okay? Question? It's more likely probably a slave. Yeah, it would more likely be a slave because economically you'd consider that distinction, I'm sure, if you were. Yeah, she would, that's right, she would be released again at the end of a certain period of time, right? Yeah. Yeah, it does. It does in the case of where you have that stipulation. That's correct. Again, you would have a situation where she would be released. In fact, the next verses are going to qualify some of the things about female slaves. But again, you have the potentiality of her being released at the end of 6 years.
And then the children would be there, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. All right. And the next one, verses 7 through 11, are special regulations for female slaves. Okay. Okay, verse 7. Every one of these points is important. And if a man sell his daughter to be a maidservant, and we're not told the conditions under which he would do it, we're just simply told that he would do it, she shall not go out at, excuse me, as the men servants do. Now, she really does go out as the men servants do, but this is a special case, as we'll see. You have to read verse 8. If she please not her master, who hath betrothed her to himself. In other words, she's not just sold to a master as a servant, but she's sold as a wife. Okay? So it's a special case. So what you have to do is put verse 7 and 8 together, and the idea is this. If purchased to be a wife, now then it's obvious, she could not be released. She could not be released after 6 years. Okay? But others could. And I want to show you that. Others could. Will you look at Deuteronomy chapter 15 and verse 17? And the purpose of showing you this is that to make a distinction that female slaves were treated just like male slaves in terms of releasing after 6 years of servitude or if the year of Jubilee came. Okay. Look at verse 16 of chapter 15 of Deuteronomy. And it shall be if he say unto thee, I will not go away from thee, because he loveth you and your house, because he is well with you, then you shall take an awl and thrust it through his ear in the door, and he shall be your servant forever. And also unto thy maidservant shalt thou do likewise. And the indication there is that if the maidservant didn't voluntarily, if she didn't voluntarily ask for perpetual servitude, she was to be released just like the men were after 6 years or if the year of Jubilee came along. Okay? Okay. So here's a guy, and he sells his daughter to be a wife. Okay? Verse 8. And she pleased not her master, who hath betrothed her for himself. Then what can he do? Is he free to treat her like a chattel slave and just shovel her around? No. Then shall he let her be redeemed. To sell her unto a strange nation, he shall have no power. In other words, she can be bought back, but she cannot be purchased by a foreigner. No Hebrew could be sold to a foreigner. No Hebrew could ever marry a foreigner under the Levitical economy. Okay? So the concept in verse 8 is that one purchased as a wife is entitled to wifely privileges over a lifetime. Okay? Verse 8. He's not allowed to sell her to a strange nation, seeing he hath dealt deceitfully with her. And if he hath betrothed her unto his son, now we have a special case, he shall deal with her after the manner of daughters. In other words, if he bought her from somebody to betroth her to his son, he's not allowed to treat her as a servant at all. He has to treat her as a daughter. Verse 10. If he take him another, and you notice the King James supplies the word wife properly, that's right, then he has to provide for this first woman that he purchased, her food, her raiment, and her duty of marriage, which is conjugal rights, shall he not diminish? Okay? In other words, what is stipulated in verses 8 through 10 is simply one purchased as a wife was entitled to lifetime wifely privileges. Okay? And those are spelled out at least three ways. Food, clothing, and conjugal rights. See? Now there's not a code of ancient law that anywhere touches the hem of the garment of what you have here in terms of protecting people sold in servitude. Females could never be sold to a stranger. These women were, you know where it's, the King James says in verse 8, then shall he let her be redeemed? That's not the best translation. That's a hifil imperative, and the hifil stem is causative action. So what it literally says is this, then let him cause her to be redeemed. That is, let him see to it that some other Hebrew, but no foreigner, redeems this woman, pays the purchase price for her. Okay? Okay. In verse 11, there is a potentiality of freedom. If he does not do these three unto her, that is, if he doesn't provide her with food and raiment would include housing and so on, and the conjugal rights, then he shall let her go free without money, meaning her father was not required to refund any of the price paid for her. Okay? You must understand that in that ancient economies and systems were very, very chauvinistic, that the father in the home had complete control of his children. And he could do that. He could sell a daughter. He could sell a child into slavery if he so chose for whatever reason. Okay, so that first section then deals with certain rights, certain privileges, certain protection for slaves or servants so that they would not be treated as just some hunk of meat, so to speak. Question? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, you have. It isn't that the law is okaying that, but what this law is doing is making provision for that first wife so that that person could not discard her or maltreat her or throw her out some way. You'll find all through the Old Testament you'll have plurality of wives, but you don't have any. What you have in the Old Testament is something similar to drunkenness relative to multiple wives. You always have the evil of it and the problems related to it graphically portrayed or illustrated. David's problems revolved around a multiplicity of wives. Some of his problems, many of his problems. Solomon's problems around a multiplicity of wives. You have the same thing with drunkenness. Every time you have drunkenness in the Old Testament, you have some manifestation of evil. Like Noah when he got, or not Noah, but Lot, so on. Noah? Noah didn't get drunk, did he? No. Okay. Okay. That's right, yeah, okay. Well, so. It's Tuesday. Yeah. Noah, that's right. Okay. Any other questions like that? Okay. Now the last paragraph is a detailed account of laws concerning personal injury. Laws concerning personal injury. Okay? Okay, and the first thing he's going to start out with are acts of homicide, verses 12 through 14. Acts of homicide. And I want to show you sort of a little diagram that I made that kind of illustrates the biblical concept of life and homicide. Okay. In the biblical concept of all extension of life, God is at the top of a pyramid, okay? And God is viewed scripturally, both Old Testament and New Testament, as both the owner of and dispenser of life. All life is seen as some type of an extension of God, okay? So God gives to Homo sapien, we'll draw a line extending from God down with an arrow, to Homo sapien, he grants to Homo sapien the right to life. the right to life. And it's to be seen by man, by Homo sapien, as a trust from God, something to be guarded, something to be protected. In fact, Homo sapien will be said to be in the image of God, both in his unfallen state and in his fallen state, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. Fallen man is seen to be in the image of God, and one has to be careful with great respect how he treats the life of Homo sapien. Okay? So over here, we're on another leg of a triangle, but we'll start with the point. We're going to have a murderer, okay? This is a murderer, and I'm not to any resemblance to Art. It's purely an accident. We'll make this his little spear gun or something like that. There's his spear gun, and he's going to do Homo sapien in. So a murderer in Scripture, a murderer is a usurper of life. Okay? He is arrogance personified. He is arrogance in its apex. He takes upon himself the right to take somebody's life. Okay? And in so doing that, then, he sins against man, the individual. He sins against the individual. But that is not all. He also sins against mankind or the community. Okay? And he also sins against God, because he has shown disrespect for the owner and dispenser of life. So that under the Levitical economy, the community, as God's agents, are to inflict the death penalty on that person, usually by stoning. If the arrogance that is expressed is seen as arrogance against God, then the community does it. If the arrogance expressed is seen as some personal hostility just toward an individual, then the person's kinsmen are to take this person's life. So that there are two potentialities for the doing in of this murderer. One, the community does it by stoning. The other is a kinsman can inflict the death penalty, and in which case it is called the avenger of blood. Okay? So in your notes, capital punishment. Capital punishment could come two ways. One, the community. Okay? And usually that was by stoning. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 2 through 17. Leviticus 24, verses 10 through 16. Numbers chapter 15, verse 35 and 36. Or it could come by what is called the avenger of blood, in which case your nearest kinsman, if you were an adult and you had a brother, your brother may avenge your death. Okay? Okay. Numbers chapter 35, verse 19 through 25, describes that in detail. It's repeated once again in Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 12. Okay? Okay, now let's go through this passage, and I read some of these when we were showing how, trying to illustrate the command, thou shalt not kill or commit murder. Okay, back to Exodus 21 and verse 12. He that smiteth a man, so that he die, shall surely be put to death. Okay, now that is premeditated murder. Verse 12, this is chapter 21. And verse 12, you have a case of premeditated murder. Okay? Premeditated murder is usually murder with malice and aforethought. And the penalty, of course, was capital punishment. Now, verse 13 is another side of the coin. Verse 13 is a case of justified homicide. Justified homicide. Or manslaughter. Okay, and it reads this way. If a man lie not in wait, that is, he isn't lurking in the driveway or behind the Fitzers, waiting for a guy to come home and to rob him or so on, or to kill him. He isn't lying in wait, but God delivers him into his hand. Then I will appoint thee a place whither he shall flee. And the idea is that you have a personal enemy. And you're not out purposely trying to do the guy in, but God delivers him into your hand, and you slay him, you kill him, okay? For some justifiable reason, he's your enemy, and he's seeking to kill you. It's either you or him. You kill the person. You have a case of justified homicide. Then we're told in the verse that God, then I will appoint, I is God there, will appoint thee a place whither he shall flee, okay? When they get into the land, which is some 40 years after this, or 38 years after this, and they divide the land up among the 12 tribes, then God appoints six cities of refuge, three on the east side of Jordan, three on the west side of the Jordan River, and any person that fell into this category was protected in those cities. He could not be killed by an avenger of blood, by a kinsman of somebody that he killed in a case of justified homicide. So what you have is six cities of refuge. Okay? For those involved in this. Okay, and these then become appointed by the Lord in Joshua chapter 20, after the land is divided. Okay? Now suppose somebody though, suppose somebody, and the altar, of course, was a place of protection. Suppose somebody went to the altar, fled to the altar in terms of mercy, but he was really guilty. Well, that person is taken up in verse 14. If a man come presumptuously upon his neighbor to slay him with guile, I mean, that is clearly premeditated murder, thou shalt take him away from mine altar that he may die. In other words, there is no mercy at the altar for a murderer who commits, who murders with malice aforethought or premeditated murder. All of, that's a capital offense, and his life is to be taken from him. Okay? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and also because of all other verses on capital punishment that you find in the Old Testament. In other words, you have a qualification. Yes, this is in contrast to this. Yes. Well, when he flees to the city of refuge, okay, there's he can temporarily stay there a certain amount of time, and I don't quite understand all the implications of it. It's till the high priest dies, and I don't quite understand the implication of that. Perhaps there was some announcement or something when a new high priest came in of absolute forgiveness for these people, and then that set them free, so to speak. It could either be that way, or or he could bring his case to court. He could bring his case to a court, to the judges, if he had enough witnesses and so on. And then they could declare that person to be exonerated in the crime. In which case, then, some avenger of blood or some kinsman person of the person that he slew could not come back at him. It would have been settled in court. Yes. No, I think he would have to have his case back. He'd have to have some type of trial back where the crime was, most likely under the social condition that they lived in, and the social conditions they lived in then. In other words, it'd be most likely in the judges within his tribe that it would be handled in, whereas the six cities of refuge may not be located. None of the cities might be located within his tribe. But, see, nobody could touch him when he was in those cities of refuge. Unless they took their case to the judges, and then the judges made a declaration, you see. The judges, you see. Yes. Yes, that's correct. That's correct. Okay? Question? Well, they're very similar. There are degrees of manslaughter. Suppose somebody attacked you on the way home and you had a pair of scissors in your purse and you took them out and you stabbed the person and killed them. That's a form of manslaughter. And in our country, under our law system, we have first, second, third degrees of manslaughter, I think. And I don't know the clear distinctions of them. But that would be a form of justifiable homicide. You were justified in taking that person's life. Suppose a man came in to rob your store. Did you read the one about 7-Eleven the other day? Did you read that in the paper the other day? There was a man. Apparently this 7-Eleven store stayed open 24 hours a day. And there was a guy that came in at 3 o'clock in the morning. And he had a pair of scissors. And he threatened the clerk. He says, "I want the money." The clerk opens the drawer, takes out the money, and when he does it, he also takes out a gun. He hands the guy the money, and then he points the gun at him and says, "I'm going to shoot you if you don't put the money down." The guy stuck his hand in his pocket and says, "Well, I have a gun too." He says, "I don't know who will get first, but I'm leaving." And he grabs the muscular dystrophy dime jar, or whatever it was, on the counter to take it with him. And he walks out of the store. And the young guy goes out and points the gun at him and says, "I want you to put the money down. I'm going to shoot if you don't put the money down." And the guy just keeps going and he shoots him. And he paralyzed the guy from the waist down. Now the guy and his family has sued that person and 7-Eleven for $11 million. This is in Denver. This is in Denver. This is local. And the parents have sued along with them because they said the boy that was shot, the young man that was shot, was their means of a livelihood. and listen. Of course they had the guy nailed. I mean, he wasn't going to get away. But before 24 hours was up, 7-Eleven had dropped all charges against the man and had made an apology and said, our clerks are trained not to brandish a weapon or to fire any weapon at anybody. And that's the training that we give them. And they issued an apology. Within 24 hours of the crime, they had issued this apology to the guy that got shot. So, but anyhow, a hypothetical case. A guy comes in and points a gun at you and threatens you, and you pull your gun and you shoot him. As far as I'm concerned, it's justifiable homicide. Now, don't try it, but you might get the chair. But normally, that would have been justified homicide. Yeah. Well, there's various degrees of manslaughter. Not in every case is it self-defense. Yeah, she will not get the chair, I don't think. I don't think that she'll get capital punishment out of that. Well, I would consider what she did a form of murder, but under her appeal or under the charge that's levied on her, it's not premeditated murder. In other words, it's not the first degree murder that used to require capital punishment in this country. Yeah, if they use that term, it's correct. Yeah. Clear. That's it. I'm not in the. Is it something unclear? You mean what first and second degree manslaughter is? Oh, well. Okay. Let's move on. In verses 15 through 36, which is the larger part of this paragraph, rest of the chapter, you have inflictions of physical injury. One of the reasons that I'm going to go through this whole thing is I just don't think anyone ever does it. And there's a lot of interesting stuff in here. And I think you really have some very clear illustrations how God is trying to implement the moral law. Okay? In verses 15 and 17, we have two violent type of sins against parents, both of which require capital punishment. He that smiteth his father, and the concept is that he didn't just do it once, but this person is abusing his parents systematically or duratively, he shall surely be put to death. Now that's physical violence. In verse 17, you have a person that's expressing a verbal violence. He that curses his father or mother, and again, it's the idea they didn't just do it once, they do it in perpetuity, he shall surely be put to death. So the first illustration that we have, or the first law that we have, is perpetual violence to parents. And again, it's capital punishment, and it's either or. It's verbal and physical. Okay? In other words, God is preserving the authority of the home and the respect in the home, and he places that kind of a sin on a par with murder. Okay? In verse 16, kidnapping. Kidnapping. And he that stealeth a man and selleth him, or if he be found in his hand, either way, if he's guilty of a capital offense, he shall be surely put to death. In ancient times, there were not that many wealthy people that kidnapping was a common practice for ransom. The common practice for kidnapping in ancient times was to sell the person. And the way you got your ransom was to sell them to somebody as a slave, like Joseph was sold and taken into a foreign country. And that was a very, very common thing in ancient times. So that was a capital offense. Again, that was disrespect for the liberty of a person, of a life. Okay? Okay. In the third instance, which includes verse 18 and 19, we have fights leading to injuries. Fights leading to injuries. Okay? Verse 18, and if men strive together, and one smite the other with a stone, he picks up the thing closest to him, or with his fist, and the person doesn't die, but he keeps his bed, or he's confined to the bed, recovery time. And if he rise again and walk abroad on his staff, then shall he that smote him be quit, or the word quit means guiltless in terms of legal claims. But he must pay for the loss of his time. And then we have another hiphil stem that's finally translated in the King James. He shall cause him to be thoroughly healed. So the point is this. Bodily injury was not a capital offense, but restitution was twofold. Restitution was twofold. Number one, pay the doctor bills and see to it. See to it. See, cause him to be healed. Make sure that that person is cared for in terms of his physical therapy. Okay. The second thing was that he was to pay for the loss of time. If again, if a shekel was a daily wage, then if he missed 10 days of work, then he owed him 10 shekels. Okay. Okay. The fourth thing under physical injuries in terms of law and restitution had to do with slaves. Verse 20 and 21, verse 26 and 27, injuries to slaves. Servants. Okay, verse 20 and 21. And if a man smite his servant or his maid with a rod, and he die under his hand, he shall surely be punished. Now, we're not told how he was to be punished. We're not told the precise punishment that was recommended. Okay, he would probably be punished by some court of law, by the judges. And most likely the implication would be that it would be a capital offense, either manslaughter, most likely a form of manslaughter. Notwithstanding, if he continue a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his money. That is, the slave represents his own money, the master's money. And the idea was that it was obvious if this person lived that the master was not trying to inflict a death blow on the man. so that the loss of the servant was considered to be a personal loss to the person. Okay? Okay. He was not intent on killing him. Let's skip down to verse 26. And if a man smite the eye of his servant or the eye of his maid, that it perish, he shall let him go free for his eye's sake. And if he smite out his manservant's tooth or his maidservant's tooth, he shall let him go free for his tooth's sake. In other words, he hits the servant in the mouth and knocks his tooth out, and the servant's free, which was probably a good angle to work on if you were a servant, you know. Start an argument with the boss and get your teeth knocked out, and then he had to set you free.
It's like trying to incur some kind of injury.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Right. Or if you were in the military and you didn't want to go overseas in the war, you managed to break your arm or leg somewhere along the way. Okay. All right. Okay. The next one had to do with injuries to pregnant women. Here we have a principle that is characteristic of the law and very important. Injuries to pregnant women. Okay. The expression that's characteristic of the law comes in this little paragraph, verse 22. If men strive and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit depart, you may have in your Bible so that she miscarries. I wish they wouldn't translate that way. I wish they would translate it literally, which would be, if men strive and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit comes out. See, or her fruit departs from her body, like the King James says, which is a literal translation. And the implication is it comes out alive. So that the next clause says, and yet no mischief follow. Now that's one of the places where the King James just needs really some help, because the word mischief doesn't mean what it meant then. The word is asan in Hebrew, and the word means injury or harm. It means that quite consistently in the Old Testament. So the idea is this. If a man strive and hurt a woman with child so that her fruit comes out and no harm follows, means no harm follows the child, no harm follows the woman, he shall be surely punished according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as judges determine. There you have an indication of the judges getting in the act. And if any harm or mischief follow, the woman dies or the baby dies, then thou shalt give life for life, or nephesh for nephesh, soul for soul, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. There is that characteristic phrase of the law, which is called the principle of lex talionis. And this is a key principle in all of the law. Have you heard of this? Lex talionis, which simply means the law of retaliation. The law of retaliation. And the law of retaliation under the Sinaitic covenant sought to make the penalty commensurate with the crime, just what we're supposed to do even today, but we haven't been too successful with it. We've softened too much. At one time in this country, kidnapping was a capital offense. I mean, that means you were done if you kidnapped somebody. It no longer is. Okay. The penalty was to be commensurate with the crime. And if in the case of a woman miscarrying, if the child died or the woman died or harm followed, then that the person that was responsible was to be treated equally. If somebody died, his life was to be taken from him. Okay? Okay. Just a couple more, and I want to finish this chapter, okay? And we'll quit. Verse 28 through 32 has some injuries caused by animals. Injuries by animals. Okay? I think this is interesting because animals were very important to this economy. So you read in verse 28, if an ox gore a man or a woman that they die, then the ox shall be stoned, and his flesh shall not be eaten. But the owner of the ox shall be quit, or not liable under lawsuit and so on. But if the ox, if it was characteristic of the ox that in the past that he would be trying to, gore people, push with his horn, and it has been testified to his owner, that is, somebody already told the guy, and he hath not kept him in, but he that hath killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and his owner also shall be put to death. Okay? In other words, you just couldn't let an ox like that run around. Or you couldn't drive your ox around like that, or your camel, or your Cadillac. You were liable. If there be laid on him a sum of money, then he shall give for the ransom of his life whatsoever is laid upon him. In other words, that would be a crime of negligence, and it was redeemable in an amount determined by a judge. Whether he have gored a son, verse 31, or gored a daughter, according to this judgment shall it be done unto him. If the ox shall push a manservant or a maidservant, he shall give unto their master 30 shekels of silver, which was the redemptive price of a slave, and which then eventually becomes the price that is paid for the betrayal of Jesus Christ, treated like a slave. And the ox shall be stoned. Okay? Okay, the last paragraph, verse 33 through 36, are property injuries. Injuries. Property. Caused by negligence. Caused by negligence. Okay? Verse 33. If a man shall open a pit, or if a man shall dig a pit and not cover it. All right? Now, that was a very common thing because they needed, they dug wells, cisterns. Very common, very important in Palestine. But so was livestock very important. So here's a guy, he digs a pit, okay? And he doesn't cover it. And an ox and an ass falls in it. Then the owner of the pit shall make it good, restitution. He shall give money unto the owner of them, and the dead beast shall be his. And if one man's ox hurt another's, that he die, then shall they sell the live ox and divide the money of it. Sounds like a good capitalistic approach. And the dead ox they also shall divide. Or if it be known that the ox has used to push in times past, that he's always going around goring people, or he's always chasing the mailman, his owner hath not kept him in, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead shall be his own. So, that's illustrative of God's respect for life in the passage, God's respect for private property, the encouragement of people not to be indifferent to private property, that they are to be responsible citizens. You see, the thing is just pregnant with implications of divine viewpoint for our age. And you're going to find that the majority of our laws in Western civilization are based upon the Book of the Covenant and the moral law of Israel. It hasn't been too long that those laws were enforced, too long that those laws were still enforced in this country. They're not being enforced now, but they were. The laws of Western civilization were based largely on Judaic Christian culture and also some codification of Roman law that came from Justinian in the 6th century. Any questions you might have? Okay, next week we'll talk about chapter 22. Hope you can be here. Shall we close in prayer? Father, we thank you for the tremendous material prosperity that you have blessed our country with. We know that there are pitfalls with this, that the problem of greed, the problem of jealousy, of envy, of lust that all of us have in our sin nature, the problem of becoming materialists that we're confronted with daily. At the same time, we would remember to be grateful. Such tremendous economic blessing where just the concept of selling a child into servitude is so repugnant and verbally almost impossible in our mentalities. And yet we know that not too far removed historically, this was even done in our country. Now we pray that this study of the law will give us appreciation for yourself, for what you were doing in Israel in that time and what you're doing today. In Christ's name, amen.